on a difficult, expensive problem. We look forward to both the presentation and discussion about the Portland building. I'll hand it over to our Chief Administrative Officer, Mr. Miller. Take us from here. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. How are we doing on feedback? This will be an interesting morning because all of you have seen something about the renovation of the Portland building. We've had a previous work session, and I've invited today not only some key presenters, but also people from the advisory committee who could make it that we have at the table. I think we're probably the best thing to do right now to start with is introduce ourselves around the table, and then also anyone else who has a piece of the agenda, introduce themselves so we can see who we're dealing with. And I've got minimal control over some of the city employees, no control over the advisory committee. So, but I'm going to be inviting them to participate when it looks like an opportune time. So I'll be Fred Miller from OMF.
Bob Ball.
Alyssa Rose.
Betsy Ames, OMF.
Jamie Welts, OMF.
Ken Rusk, OMF.
Bob Keita, OMF.
Nick Fish, City Commissioner.
Carl Farrington.
Ralph Tanola, New Buildings Institute.
Elisa Kane, Planning and Sustainability.
Marina Creswell, Facility Services.
Janice Marcus.
John Russell, Volunteer and an Office Building Owner.
Tom Walsh.
You have pieces of the presentation, so like Christine. And because we're going to be efficient, you'll be hearing from all of them in fairly brief and focused pieces. But I wanted to start off, and I want to do a couple of contextual things today. But first, to sort of bring you up to date on where we are, because we've all had pieces of this discussion. But I want you to, before we launch into where we're headed and the kind of problems we're facing and hopefully conquering, I want to make sure we're all on the same level. And I'm chronological in nature, so I want to start from where I came in. And when I started this job, there was an idea of a $95 million roughly proposal to fix the leaks, which was concluded had to be done. And Marina's going to do this in a little more detail in a minute, but I want to go through at 20,000 feet. And the thought was, if you fix the leaks, you might just as well make this seismically sound, make the building seismically sound. And employees had to move out and back, presumably, when this was done. And it came up with something like $95 million. I wasn't comfortable coming into that we'd seen all the alternatives. So we stepped back and said, let's look at all the alternatives, make sure this is the best one. And we formed an advisory committee, some of whom are before you today, to try to give us their best wisdom on where we should go. And what emerged from that is not just doing the repair. If we're going to do something with the building, why not address the aging mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems, look at the ADA requirements? There are a number of things that could be done at the same time. So the recommendation that came, well, and I should say parenthetically, when Michael Graves was here, he talked about the dysfunctional interior of the building. He too would want to do something with it. So there are some challenges that we wanted to address. And the recommendation from the advisory committee, which we brought to you, was that we should really renovate the whole building and make that a legitimate building for the employees and the public. And that was in round numbers, although we're not tied to a number yet because there's lots of work to do. That was going to be something like the $175 million investment. And that you saw, and in the budget, your decision was to move to realign $3.75 million of money that would go to maintenance of the building or plugging leaks into designing the new structure, as well as making the down payment on the 5% equity contribution for bonding, the amount, because your policy has been there's a 5% equity contribution, and then we could bond the remainder. So all of that was done. And that sort of brings us to where we are today. And we've had lots of activity since that time that you'll hear about. And frankly, this is a lot of fun. People rudely ask me sometimes why I'm still working. And it's because there's some important projects, but more than that, it's the people I'm working with. And I will say this is really the most talented group I've worked with in terms of state government or PGE, in terms of looking at the task, and you're going to see this in the presentations. But we've really got a good group with this, and the advisory group has been tremendously valuable. So we are here, and I want to say, I've talked about talented people, but I'll speak longer before I expose you to that. I want to say a little bit in terms of context now, because thinking about where you're coming from, there's a map over there behind Commissioner Novick, and also one in front of you. And there are two things I want to talk about. One is the map in general terms, and then some infrastructure needs that the city has that you all are or should be aware of. Sometime back, Pat LaCrosse was trying to sell me something. I was thinking of looking for land from PGE for OMSI. And he said, you know, if you look at the downtown core, it's really a four corners. And you've got the OMSI piece. He said, ultimately, this will be connected by light rail. But you got OMSI, and across the river, you're going to have South Waterfront, OHSU. And then you get up to the post office area and Union Station. And I raise that partially because at some stage, I think you're going to deal with the post office area. And you go across the river, and you've got the Moda Center and Convention Center, but you also have the VMC, Memorial Coliseum, which I know is one of these things coming at you. So you've got the four corners. But interestingly, in the downtown, you've got the government area. And someone found the literature going back to 1912, where the design for the city of Portland was to have a government center around three park blocks, and you have federal government buildings, county, city, right here. The Portland building happens to be part of that concept. So these other infrastructure needs that we mentioned are going to be coming at you. This is the one that's right in the middle of the table at the moment. And some of these others really don't compete. I think the post office project, it doesn't compete with this the way it's structured. You can handle that as a separate time. But I'm aware you do have the Portland building, the Portland Harbor numbers will be out soon, the Memorial Coliseum is something that you'll be dealing with, the levee repair, the post office, and then if we get into infrastructure needs, I would expect someone like Commissioner Novick to say transportation, and Commissioner Fritz to say parks, and if they did that, Commissioner Saltzman might say housing. There are lots of things you need to do.
And emergency management. So we seismic yes. Infrastructure.
Very good, because that's good groundwork for the Portland building. But I understand. And so there are lots of things you have to deal with. And frankly, this last year, you've done a pretty good job of that with available resources. But I appreciate those needs are there. This is a key piece where I think we have a proposal that we're working on that will get you interested. And I think you've already indicated some interest in terms of the budget allocations. So we are at that point. I think you've got a big opportunity to impact the future of the city in terms of what I did with Four Corners and downtown. And as I say, we're dealing with that one particular piece today. Marina, who is the first talented person you'll hear from, really does know the background. She's done this before and presented this to you before, but I wanted to give you some sense of what the Portland building looks like and how we got to where we are and having looked at alternatives.
Brad, actually, can I interrupt for a second? I just want to make it clear that I don't think that we've made an irrevocable, my assumption is we haven't made an irrevocable commitment to fixing the Portland building. And looking at the reconstruction values chart, I personally would put use resources wisely above maintain and preserve an historic building. And it's my understanding that the advisory committee has looked at various other options, and so far people don't think that it's a lot cheaper to put a new building, build a new building or build it somewhere else. But I just hope that we don't come into this on the understanding that that's off the table. I mean, I think it's worthwhile, it's important to have a government center. I really much value having the Portland building next door, but I don't know how many tens of millions of dollars that's worth. Important to preserve historic buildings, but I don't know how many millions of dollars that's worth.
And I understand your point. I would say, just because you give me the opportunity, the use resources wisely is really something that came from Tom Kelly when I was talking about the Portland building. He said, talking to the Green Building Council, it's always better to reinvest in the existing structure, use the resources that way rather than going somewhere else with a new investment. And that's the reason that that's up there. I understand your use resources wisely was used in a slightly different way.
Thank you, Fred, Mayor and Commissioners. It's nice to be back. And of course, I get to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is something we've talked about quite a bit, the Portland Building. The building was completed in 1981. By 1988, we had our first study of water-related issues. By the time I started with the city in 2008, we had five major studies. We had eight separate major projects on components of the building to address water-related issues. And the issues were not going away. In 2008, we replaced roofs. We started to do more investigations. And in the process of doing those investigations, we realized that there were significant issues and we needed to look at the building holistically. We needed to do an assessment that would really address all of these issues at the same time. So in 2012, we started an envelope assessment. As we started reviewing the materials that were coming in, we realized that the water infiltration was so significant that there could actually be concerns with structural integrity of the building as well, because water coming in degrades the materials of the building, not just the materials on the outside, but the concrete structure itself. And that was a significant concern. We added structural review to our assessment, and we completed the assessment in early 2013. At that point, we started having a lot of internal discussion. We realized from looking at the assessment that this was a significant project with a lot of money involved. We started to have some early discussions with all of you. The feedback that we got was, what are our options? Is the only option to repair the building, or are there other options out there, and what have you looked at? At that point, we went back and we started to develop those other options. Fred came on. We looked at six options in total. We developed cost estimates, timelines. We looked at the assumptions in the cost estimating. We looked at the methodology. We looked at our risks. What were the constraints on the project? What were other considerations like business operations impact or potential roadblocks? We provided all of that material to an advisory group that we brought on, many of whom you've talked to as well, and said, could you please look at our materials? Tell us what we might be missing. What are the things that we haven't thought about? Let's talk about the information that's in here and say, you know, are these good options or not good options? We looked at things like doing the project, of course. We looked at selling the building and buying another building somewhere else. Could we sell it, build something new somewhere else? Could we demolish it and build it new on the site? Could we sell it and maybe just move everybody into outleases? We looked at all of those options, and we realized in looking at them that there were some pretty significant constraints, not all of which were strictly financial. The major constraint that affects so many of these options is the National Register listing on the building and what that means. First of all, from a local requirement standpoint, if we wish to demolish the building, we're looking at a Type 4 permit process. Certainly, ultimately, that comes to council for a decision, but that decision of council can be appealed to LUBA. So it's important to know that that reaches above and beyond what we're able to manage here in the city. There are also sort of the state requirements. ORS 358.653 is a state regulation that essentially says that SHPO must agree to any transfer, sale, demolition, substantial alteration, or mothball of the building because it is a National Register listed building of national significance. We looked at whether we could remove the National Register listing. That was a suggestion that had been made to us by various folks. I think you can safely say that is not going to happen. SHPO would have to agree to that. And given the swell of support for the National Register listing when it was first nominated, it's pretty unlikely that we would be able to make that happen. And if we did try, it would be a fairly lengthy process. So we already know that the historic designation provides some pretty significant constraints. One of the things that it constrains is our ability to sell the building. I think we've all talked about how nice it would be if we could sell it, and it would give us lots of options. But unfortunately, because of that National Register listing, trying to sell it to somebody else means, one, we have to have SHPO agree that we're going to sell it, and they would want to know that it's not going to change once we do sell it. A developer is going to make more money off of it if they can reskin it however they want to reskin it, as opposed to skinning it to look exactly the way it is now. But they probably wouldn't be able to do that because of the National Register listing. So it's not very attractive. Plus, it's fairly well known that it has some significant issues. The cost of demolition due to the location of where we are on the mall, the fact that we're really in this very tight little place with a lot of buildings around us, that is more than the land is worth. So that limits us on the demolition side of things. We talked about all of these things. We talked about the tight real estate market, the fact that lease rates are definitely going to be a constraint for us if we wanted to move everybody into out leases. We talked about the real property market and how that constrains what we can buy. Ultimately, I think after so many discussions with our advisory group, we came to a couple key decisions. One, repairing the envelope of the building is critical. The damage that's being done continues to be done until we stop it. So it is degrading every time water gets into the building. Two, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do the envelope and not do the seismic for a couple reasons. If the building falls down after we spend a lot of money doing the envelope, then we just wasted a lot of money doing the envelope. We're already opening up the outside of the building. We're already doing significant work. It makes a lot of sense to include the seismic as part of that. And then as we started talking about it with the advisory committee, they said, wow, if you're doing the envelope and you're doing the seismic, why aren't you addressing all the problems on the inside? You already know from your ADA transition plan that you have significant ADA upgrades that are necessary. You know that you have aging mechanical and plumbing, that you're going to have to make some pretty significant changes and repairs there. And we already know that the working environment is not incredibly great inside the Portland building as well. So if we're looking at these things, why aren't we looking at the inside as well? Why would we spend money on just doing the outside, rip everything open, do the seismic, and never touch the guts of the building? At that point, we had come to you with an estimate of $95 million for the envelope and the seismic. We came back and said, okay, let's find out what the cost would be to add the interior, to really look at that. That was when the cost changed to the $175 million. What we did know from the $175 million, though, is that there are a lot of things that were unknown. We had some assumptions in there about having to move everybody out, what that would cost. We had to make some assumptions about how the construction would proceed. Typically, those are things that you would like to have a construction contractor on board to provide the expertise that they have in a project of this magnitude and to help you really narrow down those costs. So at that point, we asked for funding to move forward with scoping the project more fully, to really understand what was going to go into it, and to bring a construction contractor on board to give us advice, to provide us with a guaranteed maximum price that would really allow us to nail down the cost of the construction, because we can only get so far conceptually. And that is where we are today.
Marina, a couple of questions. One is, and this is for you and for our advisors, if there were no historic register designation, would the recommendation as to what to do be different? And second, what is the penalty for tearing down an historic building? mean, I'm not normally an advocate of breaking the law, even if it's to your financial advantage, but just for the sake, I mean, if you're looking at it purely as a financial decision, if we could save $80 million by building a new building somewhere else as opposed to renovating this one, and the maximum penalty for tearing down an historic building is $10 million, then we would save $70 million net by doing something else. So I am curious as to those examples of penalties for tearing down an historic building.
I can't really speak to penalties for tearing it down. I will say that the cost of demolishing it is significant, and that's where that there's a cost in there, in that equation, where the demo cost alone is more than the value of the land. So that piece alone does have a true financial.
Right, but that's separate from the question of the historic designation. And as you described it, the historic designation, not just the cost of demolition, has weighed heavily in these discussions.
It has weighed heavily in the discussions, and no, we have not looked at what the penalty would be for.
Steve's question. Can't wait till the sound system. You know that.
Maybe ask the question another way.
Because you did this analysis, the rough total costs of demolition and reconstruction of a new office building of similar quality, that rolled up number was, I believe, north of $200 million, right? Demolition and replacement, not counting the cost of temporary, which in either case we're going to have a significant cost in any scenario other than put our head in the sand and keep living in the building as is. There's going to be a cost of moving people out temporarily, either in stages or all at once. And that there's a number attached to that cost. But you came up with a rough estimate of demolition plus a new building. And it might be useful to refresh council's memory about those rough categorical costs.
If I could speak real quick before we talk about those costs, one thing to keep in mind with the demolition option is that it's not just moving people out, it's actually paying the lease costs as well. So when you move people out for the demolition piece, you're adding a year plus for the demolition in lease costs. So that alone makes that more expensive than simply moving people out and for a period of time for construction. So we're adding not just the construction time period, but also the demolition time period to it. So it's going to make that a pretty significant change.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. All the discussion has been about the liabilities of owning a historic building, but I think you need to see the other side of that coin. If the truth is you own a building that's beloved by a lot of people, it was the first building, really, by a man who's become a very famous architect internationally. So that's the plus side of the coin.
Can I just, I'd like to just add to that it is the most significant, one of the most significant examples of postmodern architecture in the U.S., and it's in the architectural history books. I think, you know, aside from any kind of penalty, I think the question is, what would people think of Portland to demolish a significant historic structure like this? So I think it's more a question of reputation, and I think on the flip side, the opportunity for leadership.
I have a comment. In the last advisory meeting, what I suggested was that the city should spend the money to really understand and figure out the scope of the repairs, the cost, the problem at hand, and you're really not going to know the final answer until you have those costs in hand. And once you really understand that, then you can make a decision of whether it really would cost less to go build something somewhere else, so you're not spending the $27 or $30 million to temporarily lease and move employees back and forth, and whether you could have a sellable asset at that time. I think if you figure it out and the costs are whatever they are, you'll be able to determine then if you have a buyer who would buy the thing and still keep it historic and do the renovation. And if there is a difference in overall cost from if the city were to move and come back to the building versus sell it, that's going to be the figure that you're getting at. Is it worth it to the city of Portland to stay or to sell and do it? That's really what I think it's going to come down to for you.
Mayor, the specific answer I have in front of me, without being an expert on all the details, but I see the proceed with the renovation, $175 million, deconstruct and build new in place, $320 million, sell the Portland building, build elsewhere, I see $220 million. I guess I'd get to a point of you may be able to find a spot to build something, and let's say it was $10 million less than whatever it ends up being. I'm not wedded to the 175 because we haven't costed it out. But then you do miss the opportunity of doing a lot of things that are basically city policy on the sustainability, preserving the downtown government area, and so on. And it becomes a question of what's that worth? And if I had no constraints being sitting where I am of city policy, I bet I could do something. If I didn't do all the percents for one thing or another, and you're going to hear from Betsy later in terms of some of the policy challenges, you could probably do something cheaper. But I'm not sure you want to desert that, because I think after the advisory committee, we found the best alternative.
Again, I think it's just important that in the back of our minds as we proceed, that I appreciate the recapitulation of those costs. I don't think there's anybody at this table that doesn't value the architectural importance of the building. And for us as a city to do what we tell private properties to owners to do, which is if you have a historic building, you have a responsibility to the community to try to keep that building in use and keep it true to its form. We've had land use cases in this chamber not long ago on just that subject and have told people, no, you can't tear down your historic building. You should reuse it. Which the zoning code allows. So all of us subscribe to those values, but I think it's important to remember that at least at its initial view, the cost of replacing this building, demolishing this building and replacing it, was a great deal more than the cost of renovating it. So, you know, Commissioner Novick's question is this a financially responsible option, all other things momentarily set aside for at least the sake of looking at the numbers? And I think the answer is clearly yes.
I think the question about the $220 million, Fred, is what's the cost of building where? Because some people are going to think that it's a lot cheaper depending on where you're building it.
So for me, there's two main issues. One, that building is going to fall down in an earthquake. And this building was renovated for $20 million, and we're in it right now. And I would expect that if that building falls down, that this one would not fare too well, especially if it gets this way. So that to me is a basic life safety issue, that even if we were to sell it to somebody else, it's going to cost them a bazillion dollars to fix it up. They're going to have even less likelihood of being able to get around the historic landmark status. The second point is that we all promise to uphold the laws of the state of Oregon and the United States, and so I don't think it's really viable for us to not do it, although to knock it down and hope nobody notices. But I do appreciate the question.
So I'm just curious, how is the county, with respect to its new courthouse and the existing courthouse, are they not wrestling with these very same issues? How is it that they can just go straight to, we're building a new courthouse, and there's no discussion about any of these issues that we're talking about of sort of being stuck with an asset that is not, you know, not sellable? Are they having these discussions? Are they face the same dilemma as we do?
Summon me, John.
Well, I sat on that committee, and Sarah and Hoffman looked at reconstructing that building in place, and a lot of us felt that that would have been a better alternative than a new building. But it would have taken 6 years, and the truth is the judges just freaked out about the potential to sit through that demolition. But a courthouse is a vastly more complicated building because, in theory, the judge the juries, the prisoners, and so on, all have to have separate elevators, separate corridors. It's a very, very difficult building to do. It's very unlike a typical office building.
I'm just saying, at the end of the day, they're going to build a new courthouse. What are they going to do with the old courthouse? It sounds like they're going to be stuck in the same situation where we are, where we couldn't sell it without SHPO permission.
I think the county courthouse will turn out to be the best office space in the city. The skinny is the county will want to move back to it as office space. But you're talking about wonderful finishes, high ceilings, all the kinds of things that today the new tenants love.
Okay, I think we've talked about values. I don't want to belabor that one. I'd rather turn to Elisa Kane from Planning Sustainability, because she'll be talking about some of the opportunities here. And she's become part of our team that meets weekly on this project and has been very helpful.
Great. Good morning, Mayor Hales and Commissioners. I'm Elisa Kane, the Green Building Manager with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And I usually come to talk to you about policies and programs. And today I want to give you a slightly different perspective on why I think green building is so important for this building and for our community. About 17 years ago, I was working at the Rebuilding Center, a nonprofit for used building materials, and I had a frequent customer there who was a superintendent with Walsh Construction. And he was coming in and buying every scrap of 2x4 we had, you know, miscellaneous hardware. And one day he came and bought 100 5-panel doors. And I'll just say they were of storied distinction. And I got curious about what he was working on. He told me, why don't you come visit this project? I think you'll like it. So I took a hard hat tour of this three-story abandoned warehouse, which was partially burned, had holes all the way to the basement, and had this very unpleasant smell that I couldn't quite put a finger on. And the materials he was buying were going to help make the building into offices, retail, and event space. And he was describing how this was going to be a very energy-efficient building, how they were going to recycle and reuse up to 98% of the job site waste, and that the building was going to be healthy for its occupants. He called it a green building, which 17 years ago was the first time I'd ever heard of that term, and obviously not my last. And I returned to that building as it got closer to completion, and that's when I really understood what green building meant. And this is perfect in lieu of this in what we've been talking about. And green building is really about turning liabilities into assets. It's about using materials wisely and thoughtfully. It's about creating spaces where people want to work and where they're healthy. And it's about creating places that people care about. And finally, I really took this term that green building is about what's possible. So the building I'm talking about is the Gene Ballum Natural Capital Center, also known as the EcoTrust Building. I could have just as easily been talking about the White Stag, the U of O White Stag Building, the Girding Theater at the Armory, a number of brewery blocks buildings, and just to name a few. I liked the building so much in 2000 that I said, I want to work there someday. About 4 years later, I got signed on as an intern with the former Office of Sustainable Development and been with the city since. So I want to bring this back to the Portland Building. As you remember, I was here on Earth Day to propose an update to the city's green building policy that was passed in 2001, and it served us very well. It's produced 11 LEED certified buildings, 600 kilowatts of photovoltaics, 60,000 square feet of eco-roofs, and these are all on our own city buildings, and multiple green improvements to our office space. And although the Portland Building is already a LEED building, we will have to recertify under a different rating system once we do a major renovation. But I really feel that LEED is just the beginning and that our policy is just the floor and not the roof. So I know that there will be many discussions about policies and how they affect this building. Green building will just be one of those. But when it comes to making difficult decisions about what we're going to put in, what we're not going to put in, I think that we could easily get mired in discussion about LEED plaques and points. And instead, I really want to keep in mind that green building is an expression of what's possible. And like the EcoTrust building, I see that eventually the Portland building will be something that we all feel very proud of, and it'll be a place where people want to go to work. And that will contribute to us attracting the talent that we want for the city for the future, and that really it will serve us as a community for another 100 years. So just, you know, the three main things that I want us to go back to on the actual green building policy is that this become a LEED Platinum building, You know, right now we say gold. I think this could be platinum. That we cut energy use by 50%, and that we really are impeccable about how those materials get reused, where they go, and what we do with them. So thank you, and thank you for helping me explore what's possible with green building. So, you know, we have some opportunities, especially if we are going to take it down to the studs. You know, I know there'll be a seismic retrofit on that, which is very important, obviously. But at that point, we can start touching all the mechanical systems, the envelope as well. And this is about adding insulation. It's about finding the most efficient HVAC system for us. We took a tour of the Edith Green Wendell Wyatt building, which has some similar characteristics, although we won't be able to do as much with the facade as they did on that building. But they were able to cut energy use by about 60%. And so we know it's possible on these old buildings. You know, some of it, even just their elevators, they regenerate energy. They're like Priuses, you know. So they when they come down, they're creating energy as opposed to using it. Indoor air quality is going to be key. So we have to make sure we're speccing materials that don't off-gas and that are something that are interchangeable for many years to come. I know that we move around a lot as city employees, and it's just something we should be modular and be thinking ahead. I also see that, you know, we are going to have to incorporate some level of solar on this building. We have fairly limited options on the roof because there's a lot of competition for roof space there, but we'll have to get creative. And that's an opportunity to look at funding through our partners like Energy Trust of Oregon and the state. And, you know, finally, we will have to replace the eco roof. Our policy calls for that. So either we retain it as it is or we replace it with something new. Another opportunity for us to help the overall sustainability of the building and of downtown, in fact.
Mayor, can I piggyback off that? You mentioned the Edith Green building. That was an expensive project, but there was stimulus money put into that. So I guess one question is, if we swing for the fences and try to make it LEED Platinum, which is Bud Clark Commons level, mm-hmm. are there federal and state grant programs which we'd be eligible for? Can we turn this into a showcase building and get some additional resources? What is the premium in the upfront to get to platinum? And then you mentioned the energy savings over time. What do you anticipate are the long-term savings?
Okay, so I'll start off with the premium. Right now, you know, to build a LEED Gold building in Portland, you're looking at anywhere from 0 to 3% on that building. And that's because so many of our base building codes and restriction and zoning actually get you a lot of the way there. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's something that we can do pretty easily. Platinum, you start looking at really identifying energy savings measures. That's really how you get to that next level. And those may have premiums depending on what type of materials you select or what type of equipment, but that's where the incentives are. So there aren't necessarily federal incentives. There's some at the state, certainly for energy efficiency measures, and there's certainly some through Energy Trust of Oregon. The good news is BPS has staff, a new staff that replaced Dave Tews, many of you have met him over the years, who can help us identify those, and we can identify those early. And in terms of what we can save, so the Portland building spends about, let's say, $460,000 on energy every year. Cut that in half, we might be looking at some good savings, and those would be year-over-year savings for us.
Okay, moving along. And I heard Commissioner Novick's comment early about, has the council really approved this project? And I'm taking it that you have approved us going ahead and developing the costs and doing the design and so on. But we're moving ahead rapidly so that when there's the final numbers and you have them and you know that you know where we are, that we can go ahead. And so there's lots going on at the moment that Jamie Waltz will talk about, because employees are tremendously interested in this. We have a monthly meeting where anyone can show up to just talk about it, and the auditorium fills up, even though we're saying that we really don't have the project defined, but they want to know about it and want to be involved. So Jamie, talk a little bit about what's happening.
So this project is more than just a construction project. There's a lot of elements that are in play with this particular project, and over the last many months, we've been doing a lot of data collection to make sure that we're making the right decisions as we move forward. I kind of look at it as a big puzzle, and there's many different pieces that are going to come together to make the reconstruction happen. To ensure that the project is successful, not just on the construction side, we've created several different committees to help us guide through this process. The first one we've already mentioned, many people around the table, we have our advisory committee made up of external community members, experts in the field, and we're relying on them for their knowledge and expertise to help guide us on budget, timeline, scope decisions, and helping us manage expectations about what this building can become within the constraints and policies we have to work with. We'll also ask many of the members on the committee to act as the selection panel for our RFPs and contracts that we'll be bringing on. We also have a design committee, and this is we have met with all city bureau directors and have asked that members from each bureau be appointed to the design committee. That includes bureaus that are in the Portland building and outside of the Portland building. And the purpose of this committee is to provide guidance and advice on the design decisions that will have to be made. These include things like maybe what color the carpet will be, all the way up to how are we going to be working with the ADA requirements that we need to be meeting. How are we going to be addressing all user facilities with bathrooms and locker rooms? How are we going to be dealing with the different work styles and business needs of the bureaus and the taking into account all of the research that's done on setting up office spaces for the different uses. They'll be working very closely with the design and engineering consultants once they come on board to help make some decisions that will then funnel up through some of the other groups that we have going, and some of those decision or advice that comes out of the committee will eventually be coming to you all for policymaking decisions. And then the other committee we formed is the Change Management Committee. Because we have 1,300 employees working in this building who we're going to be moving out and then eventually bringing back into a completely new building, there's a lot of elements about helping usher through all of those changes and the steps that are going to be taken to do those moves, all the way from how are we going to be archiving all of the documents and all the paper that we have in the building, how are we going to be recycling and getting rid of materials that people may no longer need as they move out of their cubicles. The other role of the Change Management Committee is to help us with communication. So as Fred has said, we are communicating on many different levels about the needs of this project and what people should be expecting. So the Change Management Committee, again, has members from every bureau sitting on it, and they will act as a communication conduit from all of these different groups down to the employees in each bureau. And then when bureau employees have comments or questions or ideas that they want to feed back to our working groups, we'll use this committee as that conduit. We also have a communications plan that we're developing, and Kelly Ball will talk a little bit more about that. Fred mentioned that we have monthly meetings with all of the city employees to come and ask questions. We're giving them updates on where we're at in the process along the way. So those are just some of kind of the dealing with the human element of the project, not so much the concrete and external envelope pieces. We also have consideration of the first floor vendors. So we have people who make their livelihood from the stores that are on the first floor. We have Portlandia, we have the Bento Shop, and Galloway Sundry Shop. And we've sat down with each of the owners of these businesses and talked to them about what's possibly going to happen, because they're going to be expected to move out as well during construction. And they've expressed to us the challenges that they're going to face with their livelihoods when they have to move out, and the challenges with moving to a new location and having to build up that clientele to get to the point where they're at today with their revenue in the Portland building. And that's going to be a challenge to their livelihood. And so one of the things we'll be asking you later on is to consider, you know, how we might support them in the changes that they're going to be facing. And then the other piece is we have City Kids. A lot of our city employees utilize City Kids to take care of their children every day. And so that contract is be administered by Human Resources, and we've been working with them already to figure out where can we move City Kids within the downtown core that's still accessible by the city employees who utilize those services every day. And so we have some options that we're looking at on where we could relocate them for the interim. So With a project of this size and complexity, we're really working on analyzing the best options that we have. You'll hear in a few minutes about the contracting approaches. We've been looking at the pros and cons. We've been working with the attorney's office, procurements, internal staff to really figure out what's the best approach forward. We don't want to make any decisions without looking at the evidence first. And so we've been spending a lot of time doing data analysis that have led us to the decisions where we're at today.
Okay. May I?
Yes.
A critical assumption is whether, in fact, the building needs to be vacated for all this work to be done. And we're talking enormous cost, enormous disruption, relocations, and so on. And I personally don't think that's necessary. And have an experience with the 200 Market building, which bears remarkable similarity to this. It's about the same size. That building, when I bought it, underwent a lot more serious reconstruction than the Portland building is requiring. And it was done with the building two-thirds occupied. Now, everybody moved, but nobody who was in that building really was aware of the reconstruction that was happening. And, you know, despite the fact that an enormous amount of work was being done, but office buildings are being changed all the time. There's not a floor in any of my buildings that is the same as it was 20 years ago. I mean, we put in $1 million floor for Northwestern Mutual on the floor above the headquarters for Regents Blue Cross. They never knew that $1 million work went on. It was all done in the evenings. That's the norm for office buildings. It's a swing shift operation. The big contractors all work that way. And so City Kids, for example, could move upstairs into vacant space. You need to create some percentage of the building that's vacant to start so that work can be done on each individual floor. But please don't take it as a given that the building needs to be entirely vacated.
I'd just like to piggyback. Because I also was involved in that project, and the tenants, we wanted to make the tenants happy. You don't want them to be unhappy through this whole process. I think that's a very important thing, and we were able to do that, and they were able to plan for exactly what they wanted when they moved back into their rebuilt space, and people really enjoyed the project. So I think you want to keep in mind that you want to keep your employees very happy through this whole process.
But the people who lived through that remodeling and were very virtually unaware of all the work that was going on included Smith Barney, Public Employees Retirement System. They were not disturbed by the work that was going on in the building.
And towards the end of our presentation, you're going to hear about our process on design, build, and perhaps relocate, which would accommodate that. If someone can come in and do that and save money, we're all for that. But we've heard John on that point before and are trying to make sure that our process encompasses that idea. So enough for words for a while. We need to turn to numbers. And one of the key things right now is how do we populate the building? And you've before, I think, a couple of years ago, have seen an exercise on stacking the building with different groups of employees, different bureaus. We need to lock in terms of our future financing, who will be here. And Ken has some data, has done a lot of work on a process on equalizing rates for, I'll let you explain, in the downtown area, so that we don't have perverse incentives to leave the building for short-term savings.
Thank you, Fred, and Mayor, members of the council. We have a handout that is going around. I'm going to walk you through this. And over the course of the last few weeks or so, I've been working closely with the City Budget Office and staff in OMF Business Operations to develop a couple of options for you to consider in terms of how we would move forward with the process of setting lease rates or rates, tenant rates for our office buildings or our lease space, and how this Portland building project could be integrated into that. So setting the stage for, you know, the way we would approach this is really to set some goals and objectives around how we would distribute costs and have people pay for the space that they're in. I think it's really important that whatever policy or framework that we use, that we conform and apply city policy objectives to that. So the council adopted an ordinance in 2005 that really said our preference is for our city folks to be in our city-owned space when at all possible. And if we're not in city-owned space, then our first priority would be in leases that support historic office buildings in the downtown. So that's kind of a framework for us to consider. Another goal and objective I think that's important is that we would like to have certainty around costs and predictability and stability about that over time, so that we don't have situations where costs are moving too much up and down over time, because that creates stress for us on a budget basis and it creates problems for bureaus to manage around. Another thing that's important is that we want to make sure that we can provide a level of service for the office space that people are in that's consistent and similar, whether they're in a city space or this building or the 1900 building, or if they happen to be in lease space. So that city employees should expect and have access to a similar level of service in whatever building that they're in. And then most importantly for me is that by doing this and by looking at a framework that would allow us to manage our space efficiently and effectively over time, we're going to realize the benefits of the lease costs for our city space over the long run. And we have some unique advantages as a building owner in that by being an owner and using our own space and the financing tools that we can take advantage of, is it really in a position where if we do that effectively, we will realize the least possible cost for space in the long run. We're a perpetual tenant, if you will, of our own space, and so we should be thinking that way in the way in which we recover those costs. So on page 3 of the handout, I've looked at a couple of options to walk us through, and clearly there's lots of different ways we could slice this thing. This analysis gets complicated very quickly. I wanted to start simply. We can always make it more complex. So we really have a couple different approaches that we could follow. One is what I call the individual cost pool, or what we're currently doing. So under that arrangement, each building acts as its own individual cost pool. Rates are set around the cost of that building, and the tenants of that building get a charge. It's the same for outbuilding leases. Each lease is like its own cost pool, and the rates that result from that are given to those bureaus that occupy that lease space. The rental rates then associated with this individual cost pool approach fluctuate based on the characteristics of the building that they're in or the lease in which they operate. So lease rates can go up over time by market conditions and things like that, or the terms of the lease can dictate the lease cost. The building characteristics can affect the cost that a tenant receives. So for example, right now and for the past number of years, tenants in the Portland building have had a very low cost, less than $14 a square foot, well below market. Now they're going to be faced with, under this approach, a substantial increase in cost. So we're starting to see where the characteristics of a lease or a building can substantially affect the rates that people would pay. And as a result of that, there's less long-term predictability and stability, because the individual characteristics of those individual leases or buildings are what affect ultimate cost. Let's contrast that with an equalized cost pool approach. And this is not something that is a brand new thought. We've had this discussion with council and maybe probably 10 years ago when we were looking at different building options around the 1900 building and the Sustainability Center and things like that, of taking all of the costs associated with all the downtown space and putting it into a single pool and then distributing out a cost that represents the underlying square footage that people would occupy in a blended or equalized basis. So that's really the concept. And as a result of that, the rental rates tend to be more stable and predictable over time. If you imagine a larger cost pool, you do have things that affect cost. You have rebuilding costs or you have major improvements. But the larger, deeper the pool is, when you drop a stone into that pool, the ripples aren't nearly as substantial as if you have a small cost pool and you drop a rock into it. So the ability to dampen rates and charges over time is enhanced when you have a deep pool. And as a result of that, I think we would end up with more long-term cost stability and predictability, which is beneficial for us as we plan our budgets as a long-term owner and tenant. So in terms of the analysis that we've built here, we have some underlying assumptions that are important to understand so that we can understand the numbers that result from that. The cost pool that we've established for setting the equalized rates is for downtown office space only. We've made an assumption that at this point we're only going to look at the downtown space that the city occupies. It includes city-owned buildings, which in our case is the Portland building, City Hall, and the 1900 building. And it also includes the cost of all of the city's current leases. So the Housing Bureau, FPDNR, Revenue, CHIF, and BES, which is in Pioneer Tower, all of the outleases that are part of the cost pool as well. It excludes police and fire, even though they have some administrative offices in the Justice Center and Fire Station 1. We've treated them differently because those are really different buildings that aren't have the same tone and tenor as our own office buildings. And so for this point in the exercise, we've excluded them. And the analysis currently includes Multnomah County as a tenant in the Portland building. We don't know what their plans might be in the future, but right now we've assumed that they would remain. Our building and lease costs for our analysis are in uninflated current year dollars, so you'll see what that means when we turn to some of the charts. And we do not include at this point in time a separate financing option for those bureaus that might want to own their space. Currently in the Portland building, the Water Bureau and Environmental Services own space. We've allocated cost to them on our analysis based on that space that they own, and we haven't taken the next step and go, how might that affect you if it was actually financed by you as a piece of ownership? But that's a detail that we can get into. Doesn't substantially change the cost impact or the analysis that we'll show you. And finally,
Could you just say that again? I want to make sure I understand what you said. Okay.
We have historically we've allowed two bureaus, Water and BES, to own or buy their space in the Portland building, and it was done primarily because under their financial model that they operate within, there was a financial advantage for them to convert what might have been a tenant cost or an operating expense into what became a capital expense, a debt service or a capital expenditure. And because of that, that affects things like debt service coverage. It affects net revenues, which affects debt service coverage, and rates for those bureaus are set around the need to generate a certain level of debt service coverage to maintain the strong ratings on their bonds. So it really is a way to recharacterize the nature of the expense in a manner that produces, for those particular entities, a financial benefit in their cost recovery model and the rate setting that they do. So there was no reason why we couldn't do it. It was helpful to them. And so we did that because it created kind of a win-win situation. And that would be the same thing that we would consider in this model as well.
Finally, so that they would still be able to own their...
This wouldn't exclude that. There may be a reason why they might want to consider being part of the blended rate pool, and we could talk about that, but we don't preclude that as an option from them.
But if they wanted to do that, then the general fund would have to buy back their interest, right?
Possibly, although you could argue that the value of the property that they currently own is relatively low. It's amortized off of their balance sheet. And we've heard the discussion about if you looked at the residual value of the Portland building, if you scrape the property, they might actually end up owing something to the general fund.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to go into that?
I just want to state a general objection to the CFO talking down our assets.
Well, that's at least the next question.
John Russell here, who were actually in active discussions to acquire those assets, I find that.
Are the rates going to be asked to help with the construction costs of the Portland building, and is Multnomah County going to be asked to help?
The answer is yes. Anybody who's a tenant in that building and will be asked to pay for their cost of the building, yes. So finally, the last assumption, and we'll get into what this all means, is that we've assumed for purposes of this analysis that the cost of the Portland building is the cost that we talked about, and the budget was set around in fiscal year 2016. It's a $175 million project. 167 and a half of which is financed 20-year level debt, provided the debt service payments that became part of the two rate models that we're talking about, the individual cost pool and the equalized rate pool. So the following page of the handout shows a chart which gives you a description of how the different buildings and leases look like under the different cost options that we're looking at. And so the blue bars in this particular chart are fiscal year ending 2016 charges by building, rate per square foot, on an unequalized individual cost pool basis. So you can see the Portland building is relatively low. City Hall, which is interesting, even though all of the debt service is paid for as a direct cash transfer from the general fund, when that building was built, I mean, we did through the remodel in 1996, 98, in that time period, it's the equivalent of $50 a square foot. So it was very expensive remodel this building, mostly because it was an expensive building to remodel. And there's not that much space in it because there's a lot of public space in this building.
Explain these dollar amounts a little more, Ken. This is not what bureaus are paying.
No, this is the equivalent cost per square foot of the different buildings and leases that we're in. So the blue bars on this particular chart show what we're currently paying which is the individual cost pool approach, that every building pays its own rate based on whatever those rates might be, in 2016. The orange bars show what those would look like in 2020 if we use that same approach. Individual cost pool, you can see what happens. Portland building, under the assumption I mentioned, would jump up to about $51 or so a square foot. City Hall, on an equivalent basis, would drop quite a bit down to about $18 a square foot because the debt service goes away. The 1900 building drops from about $32 a square foot to about $16.50 a square foot. And the last set of bars are the private space leases. That's a weighted average cost of the lease space that we're in. And because these are uninflated dollars, they don't change at all. Obviously, there would be some change based on market conditions between now and then. The green line that's shown